tried to know when to leave. She sits in the bedroom and grieves. There's a sequence that starts all again.
Moby has played over 3,000 concerts all over the world and sold over 20 million records internationally. He's best known as a DJ, singer, songwriter, and musician, but for his latest album, called Destroyed, he's added photographer and director to the job description. It's with great pleasure that I welcome Moby back to our show today to talk about his 10th album and his new book of photographs. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. Now, you're releasing this in two forms, as a CD in the usual little jewel case, but mm-hmm. also as a book of photographs with a CD in the back?
Well, I've been a photographer since I was 10 years old. I've actually been doing photography and music for the same length of time, but for some reason, I was always really hesitant to show my pictures to anyone. I guess part of it was the concern of being seen as a dilettante or too much of a dilettante, because as we both know, there's a lot of precedent for musicians involving themselves in the visual arts, but usually not with very great results. So it took...
Although a lot of musicians actually started as artists. There was a time when pretty much every British rocker had gone to art school first.
Yeah, I mean, the Rolling Stones, I think, did they meet?
Mick Jagger went to London School of Economics, but Beatles were art students and so many others.
And so I was really hesitant, especially with digital photography. I was just concerned to be seen as yet another musician with a digital camera. And one of the only ways I felt sort of justified or entitled to put out a book of photographs is the fact that I grew up shooting film and working in dark rooms and printing and processing film.
Although in this case, the photographs captures the mood of the album. So I assume you felt that it was good in this case. There's a certain kind of a late night, I don't want to say lonely, but, you know.
Oh, it's very... A lot of isolation, a lot of loneliness in there.
And a lot of empty hallways. There are very few close-ups in these photographs.
Well, because when I was growing up, I assumed that musicians on tour led these like unspeakably glamorous lives. I remember when I was, I don't know, what age was I, like 16 or 17, I'd snuck backstage at the Beacon Theater and I saw a dressing room with food in it. And there were no musicians in the dressing room. It was just an empty dressing room with food in it. And I thought that was so remarkably glamorous. And so now I've spent the last 20 years touring, and I realized that most of touring, I'm not complaining because there is nothing worse than a complaining musician, but touring is not glamorous. You know, like you spend a lot of time sitting and waiting in these weird anonymous spaces like, you know, empty dressing rooms and hotel rooms.
And the food turns out to not be the best food you've ever eaten.
Unfortunately, not strangely.
It's the unripe fruit.
Yeah, like, or especially in the UK, like, they'll bring you the backstage platter that the band the week before had. So it's like, you know, some moldy bread and some mayonnaise that passed its sell-by date 6 months ago.
So is that why you wrote many of these songs while you were on tour? You just had a lot of time on your hands?
Well, part of it is I also have really bad insomnia, which... And I have insomnia that's exacerbated by changing time zones. So I never should have been a touring musician. I should have been a farmer, you know, like in upstate New York, I don't know, growing sorghum or something. But so I have really bad insomnia. And rather than just lie in bed, stare at the ceiling and curse the fact that I can't sleep, I decided to try and, you know, write essays and write music while I was on tour.
Do you nap during the day or do you just go without a lot of sleep?
I'm just always tired. I just sort of had made peace with the fact.
Please don't nod off during this interview.
Yeah, well, I've had some caffeine, so I'm in pretty good shape right now. And also, I got to sleep in my bed last night, so I'm about as like well-rested as I ever am.
Well, you used to live in New York, which is the city that never sleeps, but you've moved to L.A. Are you sleeping better as a result?
Well, I was born up on 148th Street, and I've lived in New York almost all of my life. And I will never malign the city of my birth, but I will say it's quite a lot different in 2011 than it was, let's say, in the mid-80s. You know, what I loved about New York in the 80s and the 70s and the 90s was it was cheap and anyone could live here. And
many
now,
people thought this was a more dangerous city and they love it more now.
Well, what I liked back then was the fact that it was so inexpensive. All my artist friends and writer friends could live here inexpensively, but now it's become so affluent that everyone's had to leave. So I feel like I moved to L.A. because, well, selfishly, it's warm in the wintertime. And there's a certain schadenfreude when it's January 15th and you check the weather in New York and it's 28 degrees and sleeting here and it's 72 and sunny in Los Angeles. I really appreciate that. And also, it's cheap enough that artists and writers can still afford to pay the rent in Los Angeles.
Well, you have a castle-like house that was built in 1927. It can't be that cheap.
Well, my house is not very cheap, but I like the culture that exists in L.A. that is the product of, like, you know, low rents. So my friends who are artists and writers can just sort of, you know, make their work and not worry too much about the rent.
And you you gave up drinking 3 years ago. Is that connected to the move?
I think so. I mean, because New York, as many people will attest to, like, New York is the single best place in the world to be a falling down drunk. You know, it just sort of looks after you. Like, there are a million bars, they're all open till four, and everyone from the rest of the world comes to New York to, like, walk in the footsteps of, you know, Lou Reed and Dylan Thomas and be drunk and stumble from bar to bar. And then
You can get a cab, where in L.A. Yeah. you have to drive home.
And so you sober up and suddenly you realize, like, New York is a great place to be a drunk. It's not such a great place to be a sober person.
Yeah. Let's talk about the songs on this. First of all, the name, Destroyed. The album's cover features a long curving hallway with an LED sign on the ceiling that says Destroyed. Where did you get that picture?
Well, I was in LaGuardia and I had a flight to Montreal, and as is often the case, the flight was delayed about 3 hours. So I wandered through LaGuardia and I found this strange hallway. I don't know why the hallway was open to the public, but I was walking down this long hallway and had a sign that said unattended luggage will be destroyed. But it was this little cheap sign that only fit one word at a time. So it said, like, unattended, pause, luggage, pause, will be, pause, destroyed. And the word destroyed looked so interesting against this long, desolate, empty hallway. So I just stood there in the hallway taking pictures of the sign every time it said destroyed.
Mm-hmm. And it looks almost antiseptic because it's a white hallway with this black sign,
yeah,
with orange or reddish type. And it is destroyed the message of this CD?
It's partially reflective of the fact that, as I was saying, when I'm on tour, I'm so tired. So it's just that feeling of being destroyed by exhaustion. And also, when I'm home, I'm around things that are familiar, you know, whether it's my friends, my language, my culture, my clothes, my bed. And then you go on tour and all of these accoutrements that are familiar are sort of taken away from you. And so it's that question of when the familiar is destroyed, who are we? How do we define ourselves? Where do we find comfort? And essentially, what's left?
We talked about you writing the songs for this album while you were on tour. What does that mean? They're not heavy on lyrics, so what are you doing?
Sometimes it's as simple, like the song that we were playing at the beginning. It was just me in a hotel room in Madrid with an acoustic guitar and my phone recording voice notes and sending them to myself. And other times it's actually bringing synthesizers or keyboards on tour and sitting at a desk in Stuttgart or Hong Kong at 4 o'clock in the morning writing music while everyone else is asleep.
So it always involves some kind of a technological aspect.
Yeah, sometimes
more. I mean, it's not sitting with a guitar or a piano.
Sometimes sitting with, I mean, like, there are these rare hotel rooms in the world that have pianos in the hotel room. Few and far between, but boy, when I find a hotel room with a piano in it, I want to sequester myself there and not leave.
My guest is Moby. He has a new CD, his 10th CD. There's also a book of photographs, and you can get the CD either in the usual way in that jewel box case, or you can get it in the back of a book of photographs that is published by Damiani.
Damiani, I mean, because we could have put it out through a more conventional music book photo publisher, but I wanted to do it with a small art publisher because the pictures in this book are a really odd, unconventional look at traveling and touring.
And we will be back with more after this. Stop the end before the scene. Take us up to where we've been. We see the leaves are falling now. We're back with Moby, whose latest CD, I'm afraid to say album. You know, somebody once teased me for saying album, but that's like saying dialing a number, isn't it, Moby?
Well, I still call them albums because I don't know what else to call. Like, do you call them like a compendium of MP3s? I have no idea. So I used to work in a record store and we called them albums. So I'll probably just keep calling them albums even if no one's listening to them.
Well, it's an album called Destroyed. And there's also a book of photographs that includes the album. And this is the second album on your own label, Little Idiot. What are the advantages or disadvantages of running your own label?
Well, the advantage is that for better or worse, I can kind of do whatever I want. Like, for example, when I was signed to a major label, it was very restrictive. You know, like there was a lot of pressure put on the artist, aka me, to deliver commercially viable records and do whatever we could to get them sold. And then when I finally started my own record label, the way I celebrated was putting out a single that was an instrumental called Shot in the Back of the Head that could never get played on radio, and getting David Lynch to direct a video that was so experimental it could never get played on TV, and then we gave it away for free. So one could either look at these something like that as being like a fantastic expression of unbridled, uncommercial creativity, or egregiously stupid. If you talk to my accountant, he'll think it's egregiously stupid. You talk to my friends, they think it's interesting.
Well, I thought the whole idea was to get paid for what you do. But you said the last time you were here that in 1999, before the record companies mm-hmm. went into decline, the quality of music was low, although the record companies' profits were high. Now, of course, people are talking about the possible demise of most of those record companies. What do you think about the musical quality now?
Well, it seems like there's a lot less incentive for musicians to sell out and compromise. You know, like in the old days of, you know, the 80s and 90s, the major labels would go to their artists and say, oh, if you sell out, you'll make millions of dollars. And now they go to their artists and say, oh, if you sell out, maybe you can play a cell phone store in Portugal. You know, so like there's very little incentive for musicians to make bad music.
Well, in the past, distribution was the biggest problem for small labels, but mm-hmm. the internet has changed all that, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, I have my label, Little Idiot, which is named after me because I'm small and not very mm-hmm. bright. But then I license the music to Mute Records, which is a small independent here in New York. And it's great because we're all friends. So it's not this big monolithic corporate entity. It's, you know, just a bunch of friends putting out music and doing what we can to try and get people to listen to it.
And you started something called MobyGratis.com a few years ago.
Yeah, which is, do you remember by any chance a TV show called The Fall and Rise of Reginald Perrin?
Mm-hmm.
And it was about a man who did everything in his power to fail. My accountant accuses me of this because MobyGratis.com, it's a website that gives free music to independent filmmakers and film students. And the way I've structured it, I can never make money from it. So,
but it's only independent. If somebody comes to you and says, I want to use something you've written in this commercial movie that's going to cost $80 million.
Well, they can, but then
the money
goes to the Humane Society. So I've structured it so I could never make a penny from it. And I'm sure that I'll look back at this period with great regret when I'm 80 years old and eating cat food under the Manhattan Bridge.
You'll have returned to New York.
Yeah, because if you're going to be homeless, why not live in a cold city?
So has Moby Gratis been used by many people?
Yeah, we haven't really publicized it, but I think it's been used in about 3,000 or 4,000 films now. I mean, when I say 3,000 or 4,000 films, mainly very low-budget student films and nonprofit films. So it hasn't been used in any big-budget Hollywood blockbusters, no.
You've also directed videos for some of these songs. Now, you've made music videos before, but is this your first time directing?
Yeah, and I directed one of the videos in the most unsafe way possible because I moved to Los Angeles and I got a driver's license. So I decided to make a video based on driving. So I held the video camera while I was driving on the 101 freeway at 90 miles an hour. In hindsight, that was not very bright.
You could have just mounted it on the windshield, couldn't you?
Yeah, I don't know how I wouldn't know how to do that. So I just held it with one hand while I was driving with the other hand, going 90 miles an hour down the 101. And I'm not a good driver at the best of times, but especially when I'm like focused on a video screen on this crumbling, falling apart, windy highway. Like I'm happy to be here.
So that's probably even more dangerous than talking on your cell phone.
I think so, yeah. I'm glad that it didn't go awry.
Heather Graham is in the video for The Day. How did that happen?
Well, she lives near me in Los Angeles, and I mean, forgive me for name dropping, but we were hiking one day, and I turned to her and I said, I'm making a music video that involves a beautiful avenging angel in a hospital who kills demons who live under hospital beds. Would you like to play this avenging angel? And she said yes.
Well, isn't that film about your mother's troubled past? I mean, yeah, the song?
Well, it's sort of about two things. On one hand, it's about visiting my mother in the hospital before she died, but also about the fact that living in New York for such a long time, I've had a lot of friends who've been really plagued with addiction, and the amount of time I've spent with people really trying to recover from different types of addiction. So that's sort of what both the song and the video are inspired by.
And why do you think addiction has been so much a part of music for so long? Jazz musicians, rock musicians, other people live stressful lives, but they don't wind up becoming heroin addicts.
I think part of it is one of the things that drives musicians to make music and to dedicate their lives to music is the way that music affects us emotionally. You know, it alters our neurochemistry. And a lot of musicians sort of start out from a disadvantaged place. You know, we start out sad, insecure, lonely, and music provides a lot of comfort and solace. And then we discover alcohol and drugs, which does what music does, but almost more reliably. So then musicians turn to that, you know, intoxicating, literally, combination of music, liquor, and drugs, and you become very dependent, very reliant on living in this state of altered consciousness.
Well, many of the photographs in this book have a kind of a depressed feeling. Mm-hmm. Did you, I guess that's all part of the same thing we're talking about, but did you hope that people would look at the photographs while they were listening to songs? Do you associate certain pictures with certain songs?
I mean, at this point, I'm just kind of flattered and humbled and honored if anyone makes the effort to listen to even one song that I've made. So I couldn't be so presumptuous as to say that I hope people will listen to the music while looking at the book. I mean, if someone goes online and downloads a song and listens to half of it, they've done me a great honor. I mean, if someone wants to listen to the whole album while looking at the book, that would be fantastic, but I certainly couldn't ask that of someone.
Now, Moby, I would accept that from a lot of people, but you've sold 20 million albums. At this point, you have to feel a bit affirmed.
You'd think. I mean, at some point, some sort of like, there should be like empirical, rational reinforcement for our perception of self and circumstances. But I grew up a poor white trash kid, and I never expected to have a career as a musician. So even after all this time, I'm still sort of baffled by the fact that people are at times willing to listen to the music I make.
And how did you begin? Was it as a DJ?
No, when I was really young, I studied classical music and music theory. And then when I was 13 years old, I broke my music teacher's heart and I started playing in a punk rock band and did everything in my power to unlearn the music theory that he had drilled into me.
But at least you knew more than three chords.
Yeah. And now, I mean, I have to say, like, having a background in classical music and music theory really helps when I'm trying to put the records together. Because a lot of electronic musicians don't have a musical background, and I'm really grateful for the fact that I was, at an early age, forced to study music theory.
But it's important for you also to use the electronics?
Well, yeah, I like them.
Would you ever do something that was just all acoustic?
I do acoustic shows every now and then. In fact, tomorrow I'm doing an acoustic show with John Schaefer at the Brooklyn Museum. Mm-hmm. So I love doing that, but making records, I like to make the records by myself, and having electronic instruments, it basically enables me to be a weird megalomaniac in my studio by myself.
You do have female voices accompanying you on this CD. Are they just regular backup singers?
Well, they're, for the most part, friends of mine, because I've worked with public figures in the past and rock stars, and as I'm sure you can attest to, rock stars and public figure musicians are kind of a pain in the neck. So I'd rather just, if I'm going to make music, I'd rather make music with my friends, because it's such a, this process is so much more simple. They come over, we make music, we make spaghetti, watch Family Guy or The Simpsons, go out and get a cup of coffee. Like, it's a just a much less pressured, much less stressful way in which to make music.
But they have to be able to sing in tune. And
I guess I'm lucky I have some very talented friends.
You talked about not really believing in this success, but the house that you bought, I mentioned, it's a castle-like house that had been built in 1927 in L.A., And as I understand it, people like the Rolling Stones, Jimi Hendrix, Marlon Brando mm-hmm. have lived in this house.
It's this crazy old storied house, and it looks like a Norman castle. It's right below the Hollywood sign and sort of looks out over all of Los Angeles. And I think for the last 80 or so years, a lot of odd random people have lived there. Apparently, the Rolling Stones lived there when they were making the movie, and I don't believe I can say the name of the movie because it involves a dirty word. It's Blank Sucker Blues.
Mm-hmm.
So,
thank you for not saying it.
Well, my pleasure. I love your show, and I would not want to do anything to imperil it.
Is it easier to be a vegan in L.A. than it is in New York?
It is. I mean, L.A., I always think of Annie Hall, you know, when Woody Allen and Diane Keaton are breaking up and he asks for the plate of mashed yeast. So there's a long tradition of vegetarian food in L.A. So being a vegan there, it's just as easy, if not easier, than being a vegan here.
I was thinking about Annie Hall when you talked about driving, because one of the funniest moments in that film is Woody Allen driving a shift car mm-hmm. down Sunset Boulevard.
Yep, and then when he tears up his driver's license because he doesn't deal well with authority.
So you, at this point, I'm assuming you're getting better and better at driving, because in one of the things that always struck me about Los Angeles that was odd about Los Angeles, people talk about being laid back. They don't like that New York aggressiveness. And then you get on the freeway and you go 85 miles an hour because people are pushing you and the guy behind you is on your tail. That laid back guy.
It is true. Maybe that's one of the reasons why Angelenos are sort of relaxed, because they get to unleash their inner sociopath when they're driving. So they have their time in traffic where they can be a crazy monster behind the wheel, and the rest of the time they're sort of calm and tranquil.
And the only time they seem to slow down is to look at somebody else's crash.
Yeah.
Well, so are you working on another album now?
Well, being a sort of type A overachiever, I've already finished the next record.
Will it have photographs accompanying again?
It will. There's a concept to it, and I'm hesitant to say what the concept is, because it's not the music is for the most part finished, but the visuals are not. And I don't want to be an annoying interview subject, but because it's an unfinished concept, I don't really want to say what it is.
Many people don't want to talk about their next project until it's done. After all, you might want to change it along the way.
Well, because originally this album, which is very atmospheric and electronic, was originally supposed to be an acoustic album. So things do change from when I think they're done to when they're actually done.
Destroyed is available on Little Idiot Records and also in a photographic book from Damiani, both cases called Destroyed. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, I love being here. Thank you for having me.